not Harry, Mr. Potter. But reasoning didn't work. He told the raving lunatic several times that he had never seen him before. He wasn't Ronald, didn't know any Ronalds. That had earned him a series of full-handed slaps across the face, one so hard that it bloodied his nose. The dweeby, Billy Idol-looking freak was a lot stronger than he looked. So, out of desperation, Francis finally whispered an apology to the creep. "I'm sorry. I'm so sorry. I won't do it again." And then Mr. Potter was hugging him fiercely, and he was crying all over him. Wasn't this too weird? "Oh, God, I'm so glad you're back. I was so worried about you. You must never leave me again, Ronald." Ronald. Who the hell was Ronald? And who was Mr. Potter? What was going to happen now? Was Vince really dead? Had he been killed tonight back at the college? All of these questions were exploding inside Francis's throbbing skull. So actually, it was easy for him to cry in Potter's arms, and even to hold on to him for dear life, to press his face into the fragrant black leather and whisper over and over again, "I'm so sorry. I'm so, so sorry. Oh my God, I'm sorry." And Potter answered, "I love you too, Ronald. I adore you. You'll never leave me again, will you?" "No, I promise. I'll never leave." Then Potter laughed and pulled away sharply from the boy. "Francis, dear Francis," he whispered. "Who the hell is Ronald? I'm just playing with you, boy. This is just a game of mine. You're in college. You must have figured that much out. So let's play games, Francis. Let's go out to the barn and play."
Chapter 64. I received a strange email from Monnie Donnelly at my temporary office. An update of sorts. She hadn't been suspended, Monnie said. Not yet, anyway. Plus, she had some news for me. "Need to see you tonight. Same place, same time. Very important news. M." So I arrived at the command post pub just past 7 and looked around for Monnie. What was this mysterious news she had? The bar area was crowded with customers, but I spotted her. Easy. She was the only woman. I also figured that Monnie and I might be the only non-Marines in the command post. "I couldn't talk to you over the phone at Quantico. Does that suck or what? Who do you trust?" she said when I walked up to her. "You can trust me. Of course, I don't expect you to believe that, Monnie. You have news?" "I sure do. Take a load off. I think I have some good news, actually." I took a stool beside Monnie. The bartender came and we ordered beers. Monnie started up as soon as he walked away. "I have a good friend at ERF," she began. "That's the engineering research facility at Quantico." "I know what it is. You seem to have friends everywhere." "That's true. I guess not at the Hoover building, though. Anyway, my friend alerted me to a message the Bureau got a couple of days ago, but dismissed as a crank call. It's about a website called the Wolf's Den. Supposedly, you can buy a lover at the den, as in, have someone abducted. The site is supposed to be impossible to hack into. That's the catch."
"So how did he get in, our hacker?"
"She's a genius. I suspect that's why she was ignored. Want to meet her? She's 14 years old."
Chapter 65.
Monnie had an address for the hacker in Dale City, Virginia, only about 12 miles from Quantico. The agent who'd fielded the original call hadn't followed up very well, which bothered us. So we figured the agent wouldn't mind if we did his job for him. I wasn't actually planning on taking Monnie along, but she wouldn't have it any other way. So we dropped her SUV off at her house, and she rode with me to Dale City. I'd already called ahead and spoken to the girl's mother. She sounded nervous, but she said she was glad the FBI was finally coming to talk to Lily. She added that nobody can ignore Lily for long. You'll see what I mean. A young girl in black coveralls answered the front door. I assumed she was Lily, but that turned out to be wrong. Annie was the 12-year-old sister. She certainly looked 14. She beckoned, and we stepped into the house.
"Lily is in her laboratory," said Annie. "Where else?"
Then Mrs. Olson appeared from the kitchen, and we introduced ourselves. She had on a plain white blouse and a green corduroy jumper. She was holding a greasy spatula, and I couldn't help thinking how casual the domestic scene was, especially if what Lily thought she had come upon was real. Had a 14-year-old found a possible trail that would lead us to the kidnappers? I'd heard of cases solved in stranger ways, but still.
"We call her Dr. Hawking, like Stephen Hawking."
"Her IQ is up there," said her mom, poking the cooking utensil upward for emphasis.
"Smart as she is, Lily lives on Sprite and Pixie Sticks. There's nothing I can do to influence her dietary habits."
"Is it all right if we talk to Lily now?" I asked. Mrs. Olson nodded.
"So I guess you're taking this seriously. That's so wise with Lily. She's not making any of this up, believe me."
"Well, we just want to talk to her, to be on the safe side. We're not sure that this is anything, really," which was true enough.
"Oh, it's something," said Mrs. Olson. "Lily never makes a mistake. She hasn't so far, anyway."
She pointed the spatula up the stairs.
"Second door on the right. She left it unlocked for a change, because she's expecting you. She instructed us to stay out of it."
Monty and I headed upstairs.
"They have no idea what this could be, do they?" she whispered. "I almost hope it's nothing. A false lead."
I knocked once on a wooden door that sounded hollow.
"It's open," came a high-pitched female voice. "Come."
I opened the door and looked in on a pine bedroom suite. Single bed, rumpled cow-pattern sheets, posters from MIT, Yale, and Stanford on the walls. Seated behind a blue halogen lamp at a laptop was a teenage girl. Dark hair, eyeglasses, braces on her teeth.
"I'm all set up for you," she said. "I'm Lily, of course, of course. I've been working on a decryption angle. It comes down to finding flaws in the algorithms."
Monty and I both shook Lily's hand, which was very small and seemed as fragile as an eggshell. Monty began.
"Lily, you said in your email to us that you had information that could help with the disappearances in Atlanta and Pennsylvania." "Right. But you found Mrs. Meek already. You hacked onto a very secure site."
"That's right, isn't it?" Monty asked.
"I sent out some stealth UDP scans, then IP spoofing. Their root server bit on the false packets. I planted a source code for the sniffer, finally hacked in using DNS poisoning. It's a little more complicated, but that's the basic idea."
"I get it," Monty said. Suddenly, I was very glad she was there with me at the Olson house.
"I think they know I was on with them. Actually, I'm sure of it," said Lily.
"How do you know that?" I asked her.
"They said so."
"You didn't get into too many specifics with Agent Teasy. You said you thought someone might be for sale at the site."
"Yeah, but I blew it, didn't I? Agent Teasy didn't believe me. I admitted I was 14 and a girl. How dumb of me, right?"
"I won't hold it against you," Monty said, and smiled kindly. Lily finally cracked a smile, too.
"I'm in big trouble, aren't I? Actually, I know I am. They might already know who I am."
I shook my head. "No, Lily," I said to her. "They don't know who you are or where you are. I'm sure they don't." "If they did," I thought, "you'd already be dead."
Chapter 66.
It was so eerie and strange being in the young Wonderkin's room, with her life and her family members' lives possibly in great danger. Lily had been a little coy in her message to the Bureau, so I understood how the tip might have fallen through the cracks. Also, she was 14 years old. But now that we'd met and spoken to Lily face to face, I was sure that she had something real that could help us. She'd heard them talking. Someone had been purchased while she listened. She was afraid for herself and for her family.
"Do you want to go online with them?"
Lily asked, in an excited voice.
"We could. See if they're together now. I've been working on some cool anonymizing software. I think it'll work. Not sure, though. Well, yeah, it'll work.
She smiled broadly, showing those beautiful braces. I could see in her eyes that she wanted to prove something to us.
Is this a good idea?
Moni leaned in and asked me. I pulled her aside and lowered my voice. We have to move her and the family anyway. They can't stay here now, Moni. She looked over at Lily.
Okay. Why don't you try to get online with them again? Let's see what they're up to. We'll be right here with you.
Lily talked constantly as she went through the various steps to get through the site's passwords and encrypted protection. I didn't understand any of what the 14-year-old had to say, but Moni got most of it. She was enthusiastic and supportive, but mostly impressed. Suddenly, Lily looked up in alarm.
Something's all wrong here.
She went back to her computer.
Oh, shit. God damn them, she swore. Those creeps. I can't believe this.
What's happened? Moni asked.
They changed the keys, didn't they? Worse, Lily said, and kept tapping out commands rapidly. Much, much worse. Ah, horse spit. I can't believe it.
She finally turned away from the glowing screen of her laptop.
First, I couldn't even find the site. They set up this very cool, very dynamic network. It was in Detroit, Boston, Miami, bouncing all over the place. Then when I did find it, I couldn't get on. Nobody can get into the site now, except them.
Why is that? Moni asked. What happened between the last time you got in and now?
They installed an eye scan. It's almost impossible to fool. The whole thing is run by this guy who calls himself Wolf. Wolf's a very scary dude. He's Russian. Like a wolf from Siberia? I think he's even smarter than I am. And that's fucking smart.
Chapter 67.
The next day I worked in the PSYOC conference rooms on the fifth floor of the Hoover. So did Moni Donnelly, who still felt as if she were in limbo. We were keeping what we had learned from Lily Olson quiet so that we could check out a few things. The main room was humming around us. The abductions were a major media story now. The Bureau had taken an incredible amount of heat in the past few years. They needed a win. No, I thought. We need a win. A lot of important Bureau people were at the group meeting late that night. They included the heads of the Behavioral Analysis Unit East and BAU West, the unit chief of the Child Abduction Serial Murder Investigation Resource Center, Kazmierk, and the head of Innocent Images in Baltimore, an FBI unit dedicated to finding and eliminating sexual predators on the Internet. Stacy Pollack led the discussion again. She was clearly in charge of the case. A male student from Holy Cross College in Massachusetts was missing, and a close friend of his had been found murdered on campus. Francis Deegan's physical resemblance to Benjamin Coffey, the student kidnapped in Newport, led many of us to believe that he had been selected as a replacement for Coffey, who was feared dead. I want to get approval for a reward, maybe $500,000, said Jack Arnold, who ran BAU East. No one commented on the proposal. Several agents went on making notes or using their laptops. Actually, it was dispiriting. I think I have something, I finally said from the back of the room. Stacy Pollack looked my way. A few heads popped up, reacting to the break in the group's silence more than anything. I rose at my seat. The FNG had the floor. I introduced Moni, just to be cute. Then I told them about the Wolf's Den and our meeting with 14-year-old Lily Olson. I also mentioned the Wolf, who, according to Moni's findings, might have been a Russian gangster by the name of Pasha Sorokin. His pedigree was hard to trace, especially before he moved out of the USSR. If we can get inside the den somehow, I think we'll find out something about the missing women. In the meantime, I think we need to put more heat on some of the sites already identified by Innocent Images. It seems logical that the pervs using the Wolf's Den might visit porn sites, too. We need help. If the Wolf turns out to be Pasha Sorokin, we'll need a lot of help. Stacy Pollack was interested. She led a discussion in which both Moni and I were given the third degree. It was clear that we threatened some of the other agents in the room. Then Pollock made a decision. "You can have resources," she said. "We'll watch the porn sites 24/7. Thing is, we have nothing better at this point. I want our Russian group out of New York on this, too. I can't quite believe Pasha Sorokin would be personally involved in this, but if he is, it's huge. We've been interested in Sorokin for 6 years. We're very interested in the wolf."
Chapter 68.
During the next 24 hours, more than 30 agents were assigned to surveillance of 14 different porn sites and chat rooms. It had to be one of the most lurid stakeouts ever. We didn't know exactly who we were looking for, other than anyone who happened to mention a site called Wolf's Den, or possibly the wolf. In the meantime, Monty and I were gathering all the information we could about the Red Mafia, and especially about Pasha Sorokin. Later that afternoon, I had to leave. The timing couldn't have been much worse, but there wouldn't have been any good time for this. I've been asked to attend a preliminary meeting with Christine Johnson's lawyers at the Blake Building in the DuPont Circle area. Christine was coming after little Alex. I arrived at a little before 5 and had to fight the tide of office workers streaming from the unusual 12-story structure, which actually rounded the corner where Connecticut Avenue met L. I checked the downstairs registry and saw that the tenants in the building included Mazda, Barron's, the National Safety Council, and several law offices, including Mark, Haranzo, and Denyo, which represented Christine. I trudged to the elevator bank and pushed a button. Christine wanted custody of Alex Jr. Her attorney had arranged for this meeting in hopes of resolving things without going to court or resorting to alternative dispute resolution. I had talked to my attorney in the morning and decided not to have him present, since this was an informal meeting. I tried to only have one thought as I rode the elevator to the 7th floor. Do what is best for little Alex, no matter what or how it might make me feel. I got off at 7 and was met by Gilda Haranzo, who was slim and attractive, dressed in a charcoal suit with a white silk blouse knotted at the throat. My lawyer had competed against Ms. Haranzo and told me she was good, and also on a mission. She was divorced from her physician husband and had custody of their 2 children. Her fees were high, but she and Christine had gone to Villanova together and were friends from back then. "Christine is already in the conference room, Alex," she said after introducing herself. Then she added, "I'm sorry it's come to this. This case is difficult. There are no bad people involved. Will you please follow me?" "I'm sorry it's come to this, too," I said. I wasn't so sure that there weren't any bad guys, though. We'd see soon enough. Miss Haranzo led me to a mid-sized room with gray carpeting and light blue fabric walls. There was a glass table with 6 Tony black leather chairs in the center of the room. The only things on the table were a pitcher of ice water, some glasses, and a laptop computer. A row of tall windows looked out on DuPont Circle. Christine was standing near the windows, and she didn't speak as I entered. Then she walked over to the table and sat in one of the leather chairs. "Hello, Alex," she finally said.
Chapter 69.
Gilda Haranzo slid into her seat behind her laptop, and I chose a spot across from Christine at the glass conference table. All of a sudden, the loss of little Alex seemed very real to me. The thought took my breath away. Whether it was a good decision or not, fair or unfair, Christine had walked away from us, moved thousands of miles away, and hadn't been to see him once. She'd knowingly relinquished her parental rights. Now she'd changed her mind. And what if she changed her mind again? Christine said, "Thank you for coming here, Alex. I'm sorry about the circumstances. You must believe that I'm sorry." I didn't know what to say. It wasn't that I was mad at her, but, well, maybe I was angry. I'd had little Alex almost all his life, and I couldn't stand the thought of losing him now. My stomach was dropping like an elevator in free fall. The experience was like seeing your child run into the street, about to have a serious accident,
and not being able to stop it from happening, not being able to do a thing. I sat there very quietly, and I held in a primal scream that would have shattered all the glass in the office. Then the meeting began, the informal get-together, with no bad people in the room. "Dr. Cross, thank you for taking the time to come here," Gilda Horanzo said, and threw a cordial smile my way. "Why wouldn't I come?" I asked. She nodded and smiled again. "We all want this problem to be settled amicably. You've been an excellent caregiver, and no one disputes that." "I'm his father, Ms. Horanzo," I corrected. "Of course. But Christine is able to take care of the boy now, and she is the mother. She's also a primary school principal in Seattle." I could feel my face and neck flushing. "She left Alex a year ago." Christine spoke up. "That isn't fair, Alex. I told you that you could take him for now. Our arrangement was always meant to be temporary." Ms. Horanzo asked, "Dr. Cross, isn't it true that your 82-year-old grandmother takes care of the baby most of the time?"
"We all do," I said. "And besides, Nana wasn't too old last year when Christine left to go to Seattle. She's extremely capable, and I don't think you'd ever want Nana on the witness stand." The lawyer continued,
"Your work takes you away from home frequently, doesn't it?"
I nodded. "Occasionally it does. But Alex is always well cared for. He's a happy, healthy, bright child, smiles all the time. And he's loved. He's the center of our household." Ms. Horanzo waited for me to finish. Then she started in again. I felt as if I were on trial here.
"Your work, Dr. Cross, it's dangerous. Your family has been put in grave danger before. Also, you've had intimate relationships with women since Ms. Johnson left. Isn't that so?"
I sighed. Then I slowly rose from the leather chair. "I'm sorry, but this meeting is over. Excuse me. I have to get out of here." At the door, I turned back to Christine. "This is wrong."
Chapter 70.
I had to get out of there and put my mind somewhere else for a while. I returned to the Hoover Building, and no one seemed to have missed me. I couldn't help thinking that some of these agents squirreled away in the Home Office had no idea how crimes were solved in the real world. They almost seemed to believe that you fed data into computers and eventually they spit out a criminal. "It happens on the street. Get out of this windowless crisis room with all the bad air. Work the sidewalks," I wanted to shout. But I didn't say a word. I sat at a computer and read the latest on the Russian mob. I didn't see any promising connections. Plus, I couldn't really concentrate after my meeting with Christine's lawyers. Just past 7, I packed up my things and left the Hoover Building. Nobody seemed to notice me leave. And then I wondered, is that such a bad thing? When I got home, Nana was waiting at the front door. I was just walking up the steps when she opened the door and came outside. "You watch little Alex, Damon. We'll be back in a while," she called through the screen door. Nana limped down the front stairs and I followed her. "Where are we going?" I asked.
"We're going for a drive," she said. "You and I have some things to talk about."
Oh, shit, I thought. I got back in the old Porsche and started it up. Nana flopped down in the passenger seat.
"Drive," she said.
"Yes, Miss Daisy."
"Don't give me any of your lip either or your sorry attempts at wit."
"Yes, ma'am."
"That's a good example of your lip."
"I know it is, ma'am."
I decided to head out west, toward the Shenandoah Mountains, a pretty ride and one of Nana's favorites. For the first part of the drive, we were both fairly quiet, unusual for the two of us.
"What happened at the lawyer's?" Nana finally asked as I turned onto Route 66.
I gave her the long version, probably because I needed to vent. She listened very quietly. Then she did something unusual for her. Nana actually cursed.
The hell with Christine Johnson. She's wrong about this.
I can't completely blame Christine, I said. As much as I didn't want to, I could see her side of things.
Well, I do. She left that sweet little baby and went to Seattle. She didn't have to go that far away. Her decision. Now she has to live with it.
I glanced over at Nana. Her face was screwed tight. I don't know if that would be considered an enlightened point of view these days. Nana waved away what I'd said.
I don't think these days are all that enlightened. You know I believe in women's rights, mother's rights, all of that. But I also believe you have to be held responsible for your actions. Christine walked away from that little boy. She walked away from her responsibility.
You through? I asked. Nana had her arms folded tightly across her chest.
I am. And it felt good, real good. You ought to try it sometime. Vent, Alex. Lose control. Let it out.
I finally had to laugh. I had the radio blasting all the way home from work, and I was yelling half the time. I'm more upset than you are, Nana. For once. And I don't ever remember this happening before. She actually let me have the last word.
Chapter 71.
Jamila called that night around 11 o'clock, 8 o'clock her time. I hadn't spoken to her for a few days, and to be truthful, now wasn't the best time. Christine's visit to D.C. and the meeting with her lawyer had me tense and messed up, shook. I tried not to show it, but that was wrong, too.
You never write, you never call, Jamila said,
and laughed in her usual loose and engaging way.
Don't tell me, you're already wrapped up in a case for the Bureau. You are, aren't you?
A big nasty one, yeah. I'm sort of in and out of it, I told Jam, then quickly explained what was happening and what wasn't at the Hoover Building, including my mixed emotions about being with the Bureau. All the stuff in my life that didn't really matter right now.
You're the new guy on the block, she said. Give it some time.
I'm trying to be patient. It's just that I'm not used to this wasted motion, the wasted resources. I heard her laugh.
That, and you're used to being the center of attention, don't you think? You've been a star, Alex.
I smiled. You're right, you're right. That's part of it.
You saw the Bureau from the other side of the fence. You knew what you were getting yourself into.
Didn't you know? I guess I should have, sure. But I listened to a lot of promises that were made when I signed up. Jamila sighed.
I know, I'm not being very sympathetic, empathetic, whatever. One of my faults.
No, it's me.
Yeah,
she laughed again.
It is. I never heard you so down and out. Let's see what we can do to bring you up.
We talked about the case she was working on. Then Jamila asked about each of the kids. She was interested, as always. But I was in a sour mood, and I couldn't shake it. I wondered if she could tell, and then I got my answer.
Well, Jam said, I just wanted to see how you were. Call if you have any news. I'm always here for you. I miss you, Alex.
I miss you, too, I said. Then Jamila broke the connection with a soft, bye. I sat there shaking my head back and forth. Shit. What an ass I was sometimes. I was blaming Jamila for what had happened with Christine, wasn't I? How dumb was that?
Chapter 72.
Hi there. I missed you, I said, and smiled. And I'm sorry. 5 minutes after Jamila hung up, I called her back to try and make amends.
You should be sorry, you poop. Glad to see your famous Santenni are still working all right, she said.
Not so hard to figure out. The crucial evidence was right before my eyes. That was the shortest phone talk we've ever had. Probably the most uncomfortable and frustrating, too. I had one of my famous feelings about it.
So what's the matter, Boy Scout? Is it the job or is it something else? Is it me, Alex? You can tell me if it is. I have to warn you, though. I carry a gun. I laughed at her joke. Then I took a breath and let it out slowly. Christine Johnson is back in town. It gets worse from there. She came for little Alex. She wants to take him away, to get custody, probably take him to Seattle. I heard a sharp intake of breath, then, oh, Alex, that's terrible. Terrible. Did you talk to her about it? I sure did. I was at her lawyer's this afternoon. Christine finds it hard to be tough. Her lawyer doesn't. Alex, has Christine seen the two of you together? How you are with him? You're like that old movie, Kramer versus Kramer. Dustin Hoffman and that cute little boy. No, she hasn't really watched us together, but I've seen her with Alex. He turned on the charm, welcomed her back without any recriminations. Little traitor. Jamila was angry now. Little Alex would. Always the perfect gentleman. Like his father. That, plus, she is his mother. The two of them have a history jam. It's complicated. No, it isn't. Not for me. Not for anybody with a brain. She left him, Alex. Separated herself by 3,000 miles. Stayed away for a year. What's to say she won't do it again? So what are you going to do now? That was the big question, wasn't it? What do you think? What would you do? Jam sniffed out a laugh. Oh, you know me. I'd fight her like hell. I finally smiled. That's what I'm going to do. I'm going to fight Christine like hell.
Chapter 73.
The phone calls weren't over for the night. As soon as I got off with Jamila, and we're talking 60 seconds here, the infernal contraption started to ring. I wondered if it was Christine. I really didn't want to talk about Alex right now. What would she want to say to me? And what could I say to her? The phone wouldn't stop ringing, though. I looked at my watch, saw it was past midnight. Now what? I hesitated before I finally snatched it up. Alex Cross, I said.
Alex, this is Ron Burns. Sorry to call you so late. I'm just flying into D.C. from New York. Another conference on counterterrorism, whatever the hell that's supposed to mean right now. Nobody seems to know exactly how to fight the bastards, but everybody has a theory.
Play by their rules. Of course, that would inconvenience a few people, I said, and it's sure not politically or socially correct. Burns laughed.
You go to the heart of the matter, he said, and you aren't timid about your ideas.
I said, speaking of which,
I know you're a little pissed, he said. I don't blame you after what's been happening. The Bureau run around, everything you were warned about. You have to understand something, Alex. I'm trying to turn around a very slow-moving ocean liner. In the Potomac. Trust me for a little longer. By the way, why are you still in D.C.? Not up in New Hampshire?
I blinked. Didn't understand.
What's in New Hampshire? Oh, shit. Don't tell me. We have a suspect. Nobody told you, did they? Your idea about tracking the mentions of the wolf's den on the internet worked. We got somebody.
I couldn't believe what I was hearing now, at midnight. Nobody told me. I've been home since I left work. There was a silence on his end.
I'm gonna make a couple of calls. Get on a plane in the morning. They'll be expecting you in New Hampshire. Believe me. They will be expecting you. And Alex, trust me a little longer.
Yeah, I will.
A little longer.
Chapter 74.
It seemed both unlikely and peculiar, but a respected assistant professor of English at Dartmouth was the subject of the FBI's surveillance in New Hampshire. He had recently gone into a chat room called Taboo and bragged about an exclusive website where anything could be bought. If you had enough money. An agent at PSYOC had downloaded the strange conversation with Mr. Potter. Boyfriend.
Exactly how much is enough money to buy anything?
Mr. Potter.
More than you have, my friend. Anyway, there's an eye scan to keep out riffraff like yourself.
The package.
We're honored that you're slumming with us tonight.
Mr. Potter.
The Wolf's Den is only open about 2 hours a week. None of you are invited, of course.
It turned out that Mr. Potter was the moniker used by Dr. Homer Taylor. Guilty or not, Dr. Taylor was under a microscope right now. 24 agents and two-person teams working 8-hour shifts were watching every step he took in Hanover. During the work week, he lived in a small Victorian house near the college and walked back and forth to classes. He was a thin, balding, proper-looking man who wore English-made suits with bright-colored bow ties and purposefully uncoordinated suspenders. He always looked very pleased with himself. We'd learned from college authorities that he was teaching Restoration and Elizabethan drama, as well as a Shakespeare seminar that semester. His classes were extremely popular, and so was he. Dr. Taylor had the reputation of being available to his students, even ones who weren't actually taking his courses. He was also known for his quick wit and nasty sense of humor. He often played to standing room only, which he called full houses, and frequently acted out scenes, both the male and female parts. It was assumed that he was gay, but no one was aware of any serious relationships the professor had. He owned a farm about 50 miles away in Webster, New Hampshire, where he spent most weekends. Occasionally, Taylor went to Boston or New York, and he'd spent several summers in Europe. There had never been an incident with a student, though some of the males called him Puck, a few to his face. The surveillance of Taylor was difficult, given the college town atmosphere. So far, it was believed that our agents hadn't been spotted, but we couldn't be certain of that. Taylor hadn't been seen doing much beyond teaching his classes and returning home. The second day in Hanover, I was in a surveillance car, a dark blue Crown Vic, along with an agent named Peggy Katz. Agent Katz had been raised in Lexington, Massachusetts. She was a very serious person whose main hobby seemed to be an avid interest in professional basketball. She could talk about the NBA or WNBA for hours, which she did during our surveillance time together. The other agents on with us that night were Roger Nielsen, Charles Puiznik, and Michelle Bugliarello. Puiznik was the special agent in charge. I wasn't really sure where I fit in, but they all knew I'd been sent by Washington and by Ron Burns himself. The good Dr. Taylor's going out. Could be interesting. Katz and I heard over our two-way late that night. We couldn't actually see his house from where we were parked. He's coming your way. You pick him up first, said Special Agent in Charge Puiznik. Katz turned on the headlights and we pulled up to a corner. Then we waited for Taylor to pass. His Toyota 4Runner appeared a moment later. He's going out toward I-89, she reported in. Proceeding at about 45, keeping within the speed limit, which makes him suspicious in my book. Maybe headed to his farm in Webster. Kinda late for picking tomatoes, though. We'll have Nielsen precede him on I-89. You stay behind. Michelle and I will be right with you, said Puiznik. That sounded familiar to me, and apparently to Agent Katz, since she muttered, right, as soon as she signed off. Once he exited 89, Taylor made turns on a couple of narrow side roads. He was doing close to 60. Seems to be in a little more of a hurry now, Peggy said. Then Taylor's Toyota veered off onto a drive that appeared to be dirt. We had to stay back or be spotted. Fog lay low over the farmlands, and we proceeded slowly until we could safely park on the side of the road. The other FBI cars hadn't arrived yet. At least, we didn't see any of them. We got out of our sedan and headed back into the woods. Then we could see Taylor's Toyota parked in front of a shadowy farmhouse. A light eventually blinked on inside the house, then another. Agent Katz was quiet, and I wondered if she'd been involved in anything quite as heavy as this before. I didn't think she had.
"We can see Taylor's Toyota at the house," she reported to Puiznik.
Then she turned to me.
"So now what?"
she asked in a whisper.
"It's not up to us," I said. "If it was?"
I'd move in closer on foot. I want to see if that missing kid from Holy Cross is in there. We don't know how much danger he's in.
Puiznik contacted us again. "We're going to take a look. You and Agent Cross stay where you are. Watch our backs."
Agent Katz turned to me and sniffed out a laugh.
"Puiznik means watch our dust, doesn't he?"
"Or eat our dust," I said.
"Well, suck hind tit,"
grumped Katz. Maybe she hadn't seen any action before, but she apparently wanted some now. And I had a feeling Agent Katz might get her wish.
Chapter 75.
"Over there, heading toward the barn," I said, and pointed. "That's Taylor." "What's he doing?"
"Puiznik is on the other side of the house. He probably can't see that Taylor's outside," said Agent Katz.
"Let's see what he's up to."
Katz hesitated.
"You're not going to get me shot, are you?"
"No," I said, a little too quickly. This was getting complicated all of a sudden. I wanted to follow Taylor, but I felt I had to watch out for Katz, too.
"Let's go,"
Katz finally said, reaching a decision.
"Taylor is out of the house. He's headed southwest," she alerted Puiznik. "We're following."
The two of us hurried forward for 100 yards or so. We had some ground to make up, and we wanted to keep Taylor in sight. There was a half moon overhead, and that helped, but it was also possible that Taylor might see us coming. We could lose him easily now, especially if he was suspicious. He didn't seem to be aware of anything going on around him, at least not so far, which got me thinking that he was used to sneaking around out here late at night, not worrying about being seen by anyone. This was his private reserve, wasn't it? I watched him go inside the barn.
"We should call in again," Katz said.
I didn't disagree completely, but I was nervous about the other agents coming up fast and making noise. How many of them had experience in the field?
"You better call in," I finally agreed.
It took the other agents a couple of minutes to get to the edge of the woods, where we were crouched behind tall brush. Light from inside the barn shone through cracks and holes in the weatherboarding. We couldn't see or hear much from where we were hiding. Then music blasted from somewhere in the barn. I recognized a choral arrangement by Queen. A lyric about riding a bicycle. Totally whacked at this time of night, playing in the middle of nowhere.
"There's no evidence of violence in his past," Puiznik said as he crouched beside me.
"Or kidnapping either," I said. "But he might have somebody in that barn. Maybe the kid from Holy Cross. Taylor knew about the wolf's den, even the eye scan. I doubt he's an innocent bystander."
"We're moving on Taylor," the senior agent ordered. "He may be armed," he told the agents. "Proceed as if he is."
He assigned Nielsen and Bugliarello to surveil the far side of the barn in case Taylor tried to get out some other way. Puiznik, Katz, and I were going in the door that Taylor had entered.
"You okay with this?" I asked Puiznik. "Going in after him now?"
"It's already been decided," he said in a tight voice. So we moved forward, toward the barn door. Queen continued to play loudly in the barn. This was a strange feeling, all of it. The Bureau had excellent resources for getting information. Their personnel were certainly book smart and well trained, but in the past I'd always known and trusted those I went into a dangerous crime scene with. The wooden barn door hadn't been latched or locked by Taylor. We could see that as we crouched in tall brush a few yards away. Suddenly, the music stopped. Then I heard loud voices inside. More than one. But I couldn't make out what was being said or who was doing the talking.
"We should take him down. Now," I whispered to Puiznik. "We're already committed. We have to go."
"Don't tell me."
"I ain't telling you," I said.
I wanted to take over from Puiznik. He was hesitating much too long. Once we had moved so close to the barn, we shouldn't have stopped.
"I'll go first. Come in behind me," I finally said.
Puiznik didn't overrule me, didn't argue. Katz didn't say a word. I ran very quickly toward the barn, my gun out of my holster. I was there in seconds. The door made a heavy creaking sound when I pulled it open. Bright light escaped outside, splintering into my eyes for a second. FBI! I yelled at the top of my voice. FBI! Jesus! Taylor looked at me, and his eyes filled with surprise, fear. I had a clear shot at him. He'd had no idea he was being followed. He'd been operating in his own private safety zone, hadn't he? I could see that now. I could also make out someone else in the shadows of the barn. He was tied with leather bindings to a wooden post attached to a beam in the hayloft. He had no clothes on. Nothing. His chest and genitals were bloodied. But Francis Deegan was alive. You're under arrest, Mr. Potter.
Chapter 76.
The first interview with Potter took place in his small library in the farmhouse. It was cozy and tastefully furnished, and gave no hint of the horrible acts going on elsewhere on the property. Potter sat on a dark wooden bench with his wrists handcuffed in front of him. His dark eyes boiled over in anger, directed at me. I sat in a straight-backed chair directly across from him. For a long moment, we glared at each other. Then I let my eyes wander around the room. Bookcases and cabinets had been custom-built and covered every wall. A large oak desk held a computer and printer, as well as wooden in-and-out boxes and stacks of ungraded papers. A green wooden sign behind the desk read, "Bless this mess." There was no hint of the real Taylor, or Potter, anywhere. I noticed authors' names on the spines of the books. Richard Russo, Jamaica Kincaid, Zadie Smith, Martin Amis, Stanley Kunitz. It was rumored that the Bureau often had an incredible amount of information on a subject before an interview was conducted. This was true with Taylor. I already knew about his boyhood spent in Iowa, then his years as a student at Iowa and NYU. No one had suspected he had a dark side. He had been up for promotion and tenure this year, and had been working to finish a book on Milton's Paradise Lost, as well as an article on John Donne. Drafts of the literary projects were laid out on the desk. I got up and looked through the pages. He's organized. He compartmentalizes beautifully, I was thinking. Interesting stuff, I said.
Be careful with those.
Oh, sorry. I'll be careful, I said, as if anything he had written about Milton or Donne mattered anymore. I continued to look through his books. The OED, The Riverside Shakespeare, Shakespeare and Milton Quarterlies, Gravity's Rainbow, a Merck manual.
This interrogation is illegal. You must know that. I want to see my lawyer,
he said, as I sat down again.
I demand it.
Oh, we're just talking, I said. This is only an interview. We're waiting for a lawyer to get here. Just getting to know you.
Has my lawyer been called, Ralph Guild in Boston? Tell me, don't fuck with me.
As far as I know. Let's see, we busted you at around 8 a.m. He was called at 8:30. Taylor looked at his watch. His dark eyes blazed.
It's only 12:30 now.
I shrugged. Well, no wonder your lawyer isn't here yet. You haven't even been apprehended. So you teach English Lit, right? I liked literature in school, read a lot, still do. But I love the sciences. Taylor continued to glare at me.
You forget that Francis was taken to the hospital. The time is on the record.
I snapped my fingers and winced. Right. Of course it is. He was picked up at a little past 9. I signed the form myself. I have a doctorate, like yourself, in psychology, from Johns Hopkins, down in Baltimore. Homer Taylor rocked back and forth on the bench. He shook his head.
You don't scare me, you fucking asshole. I can't be intimidated by little people like you. Trust me, I doubt you have a PhD, maybe from Alcorn State or Jackson State.
I ignored the baiting. Did you kill Benjamin Coffey? I think you did. We'll start looking for the body a little later this morning. Why don't you save us the trouble?
Taylor finally smiled.
Save you the trouble? Why would I do that?
I actually have a pretty good answer. Because you're going to need my help later on.
Well then, I'll save you some trouble later on, after you help me.
Taylor smirked.
What are you, the FBI's idea of affirmative action?
I smiled. No, actually, I'm your last chance. You'd better take it.
Chapter 77.
The library in the farmhouse was empty except for Potter and I. He was handcuffed, totally cool and unafraid, glaring menacingly.
I want my lawyer.
I'll bet you do. I would if I were you. I'd be making a real scene in here.
Taylor finally smiled. His teeth were badly stained.
How about a cigarette? Give me something.
I gave him one. I even lit it for him. Where did you bury Benjamin Coffey?
So, you're really the one in charge? Interesting. The world turns, doesn't it? The worm, too.
I ignored his question. Where is Benjamin Coffey? Is he buried out here? I'm sure he is.
Then why ask, if you already know the answer?
Because I don't want to waste time digging up these fields or dredging the pond over there.
I really can't help you. I don't know a Benjamin Coffey. Of course, Francis was here of his own free will. He hated it at Holy Cross. The Jesuits don't like us. Well, some of the priests don't.
The Jesuits don't like who? Who else is involved with you?
You're actually funny for a police drone. I like a bit of dry humor now and then.
I stretched my leg out, struck his chest, and knocked his bench over. He hit the floor hard, banged his head. I could see that it shook him, surprised him anyway. Must have hurt at least a little bit.
That's supposed to scare me?
He asked, once he'd gotten his breath. He was angry now, red-faced, the veins in his neck pulsing. That was a start.
I want my lawyer. I'm explicitly asking you for a lawyer. Lawyer! 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 Can anyone hear me?
Taylor kept yelling at me for over an hour, like some sociopathic kid who wasn't getting his way. I let him scream and curse until he started to get hoarse. I even went outside and stretched my legs, drank some coffee, chatted with Charlie Pwiesnik, who was a pretty good guy. When I came back inside, Potter looked changed. He'd had time to think about everything that had happened at the farm. He knew that we were talking to Francis Deegan and that we'd find Benjamin Coffey, too. Maybe a few others. He sighed out loud.
I assume we can make some sort of arrangement to my liking, mutually beneficial.
I nodded. I'm sure we can make an arrangement. But I need something concrete in return. How did you get the boys? How did it work? That's what I need to hear from you.
I waited for him to answer. Several minutes passed.
I'll tell you where Benjamin is.
He'll tell me that, too.
I waited some more. Took another turn outside with Charlie. Came back to the study.
I bought the boys from the wolf. But you'll be sorry you asked. So will I, probably. He'll make both of us pay. In my humble opinion, and remember, this is just a college professor talking, the wolf is the most dangerous man alive. He's Russian. Red Mafia.
Where do we find the wolf? How do you contact him?
I don't know where he is. Nobody does. He's a mystery man. That's his thing, his trademark. I think it turns him on.
It took several more hours of talking, bargaining, and negotiating. But Potter finally told me some of what I wanted to know about the wolf, this Russian mystery man who impressed him so.